Welcome to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars, where we unravel the stories behind some of pop's most unlikely hits.
From simple curiosities to songs that changed the world, we examine the socio-political and cultural factors that contributed to the success of these surprising outliers.
And the impact these songs had on society. I'm Tom Thompson.
And I'm Tyler Ralston. And together we're
TNT.
Hey, Mr. Ralston, how's it going today?
Hey, Mr. Thompson, how do?
Things are pretty good here. I had a beautiful ski last night. I had a giant shawarma for lunch, so I may be burping a little bit in this this episode.
Great.
In beautiful, spectacular, full stereoscopic sound. I don't even know what that is.
Well, it sounds great, whatever it is.
Did you say it was like 75 degrees Fahrenheit there today, or
it's not quite that warm today, but it was yesterday and it was absolutely delightful.
Wow.
So like, yeah, it's starting weather. To break. Winter's starting to break here. So yeah, you just have fun on your skis.
Finally, when you're mountain biking and I have mud, then it'll be payback time for me for sure.
Yeah, that's right. But I could have gone mountain bike this morning if I'd thought about it in time.
Is there a huge, here there's kind of like, there's like a month where it's just so muddy, you can't do anything. Does it kind of dry up there quicker?
Oh, it's hit or miss. I mean, it can be just total mud or just totally fine. Just depending on, again, there's no thaw here. So there's nothing like that. It's just if it's raining or not.
Right. Yeah. And I guess you don't have huge, the problem here is that we have so much snow that if you're in the woods, it takes months to actually even just melt. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's kind of sheltered from the sun. It takes a long time, and so it's a long haul between ski season and biking season here.
Takes about a day for snow to melt here, so there's not a flake of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
Hasn't been since the last time it snowed. Different worlds, my friend.
Yeah, it sounds nice.
Yeah, it's not bad. It has its pluses. All right, well, what do you got for us today, Tom?
Okay, well, this one, I'm pretty sure you're going to love this.
All right.
If you've never heard this before. And we're actually going to have a little video, I think.
Oh.
We're going to try the technology out and see how this works. So, here we go.
I said you,
looks
mate.
Good.
I said you, I'm looking at you, mate. I said you, come here. I said go away. Didn't you kill my brother?
Do you know the song?
Never heard it in my life.
My sister-in-law was an oak tree.
This was a huge, huge hit, huge much music hit for sure.
Hey, didn't you kill my brother?
Which is just bizarre. So, it's kind of an interesting thing. Like, why would you? I mean, there's been some sort of forays of comedy into music, but what a strange thing to do to pair. He was known as a comedian, and for some reason decided to do a song and music video
based on an Eastern European mafioso with an Australian accent, apparently with the guy's brother having been killed by that. Guy looks just like him.
Yeah, and I think there was actually a little film about it as well that came later, which is interesting too. Can you think of other songs that were sort of like a comedy music crossover like this?
Comedy music crossover. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Weird Al, but that's a kind of a Dr. Demento type genre in and of itself. Did you guys have Dr. Demento in Canada?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. I don't remember much about Dr. Demento, but obviously.
It dealt in those, in that genre of music comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Really kind of nerdy type comedy skits and songs and stuff like that.
Wind up your radio!
Dr. Demento coming to you from under the smogberry trees. I've been playing mad music and crazy comedy on radio since 1970. Everything from Spike Jones to Frank Zappa, from the OK Laughing Record recorded way back in 1922 to launching the career of Weird Al Yankovic with a cassette he made at home when he was just 16 years old. We have an extra special Dr. Demento.
But this one's different. I've never seen anything quite like it, really. I mean, is this guy Canadian?
No, he's British.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know why. I mean, the only thing I can figure is probably the video had a lot to do with the success of this song. It wasn't a number one hit or anything, but I believe it was top 100 in Canada, which that's not easy to do.
Certainly not. Well, give me a little background on it, like year.
I think it was early 80s, I believe. I think it was 85 it came out, I believe. And then the little film came out, I think, 3 years later, which is interesting, maybe based on the success of the song in Canada. But I think about some of the comedy that came into music. Weird Al, that's probably the example that most people would know. I would kind of throw something like, remember Right Said Fred? I'm Too Sexy for, yeah, that sort of thing. That's a bit.
Were those guys,
I suppose,
comedians?
I don't know, actually. I don't know anything about those guys.
I mean, but yeah, so. Certainly there's an element of humor involved in that.
Yeah.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts. And I'm too sexy for Milan. Milan, New York, and Japan.
What do you think about the trying to put these two things together?
Well, it's just like any genre mixing, it's like it better be good, it better be done right, or it's going to be a complete disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, Weird Al again. I mean, he had a formula that worked, even though, again, the shtick wore thin after a while. It's almost like they open up for Van Halen and stuff like that and get booed off the stage. I remember feeling really bad for him until someone explained to me once, and it's like, no, that's the point.
Right.
If Weird Al didn't get booed off the stage, they'd run out of songs after about three. It's fully expected he's going to get booed off the stage.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity. At 4:30 in the morning I'm milking cows. Jebediah feeds the chickens and Jacob plows. Fool, and I've been milking and plowing so long that even Ezekiel thinks that my mind is gone.
Right, yeah, they wouldn't be fulfilling their contract if they didn't get put off.
Right, but yeah. I mean, intentional. I mean, the best stuff, of course, is the comedy wasn't even intended. It ends up being funny. I mean, the entire decade of the 70s almost lends itself to that. The big collars and the disco shoes and all of that. Just, the cheese, the decade of cheese and 80, the 80s as well.
80s, I was going to say, maybe even more. Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, those things come back in and out of fashion periodically. But it's a good question. And, is this video supposed to be funny? I mean, it didn't just strike me as funny as opposed to quirky.
Yeah, right. It's definitely, quirky, I guess would be what you how you describe it. But I've often thought that some things shouldn't really go together. I'm not a huge fan of opera. I'm not sure how you feel about opera, but I just think that singing and drama, like musicals, I'm not really a fan of musicals as well. And I just think it's a very awkward pairing.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of opera either. Recognizing the talent involved in that style of singing and all of that. But yeah, it does nothing for me. Although musicals, again, it's sort of musicals themselves are kind of crossover. Because those traditional operas are so intense with that, those voices and stuff, but the musical, you seem to have a little more room to play.
25,600 minutes, 525,000 moments, oh dear. 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year? In daylights, in sunsets, in midnights, in cups of coffee, in inches, in miles, in
life. And it's not, you know, the singing is, can be operatic, but not necessarily.
Yeah. And I think that I have a big problem, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I have a big problem with when you go to see a show, a live show, and it's choreographed. To me, that's not rock and roll. I think there's just something that when you're playing rock music live, it should just be a free thing where you're not thinking about dance moves and that sort of thing. That's just my take on it. I find it awkward.
You've always been a very big fan of spontaneity. I mean, that spontaneity seems to be your god. So I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I remember, you know, being critical of this guitar solo or that guitar solo. Listen how planned that is. That's just rehearsed. Listen to this one. This is straight from the heart. Spontaneous.
Did I say that?
Oh, you say stuff like that all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That is how I feel about it. And that's why, to me, live performance is king, especially these days with the amount of trickery you can do in the studio. Mm. I just think that, you know, a live performance, there's only so far you can fake a live performance. Now, I mean, there are a lot of bands who have like secret, you know, like U2, they have their secret musicians underneath the stage, doing things, which I always think is kind of lame.
If you're going to do it, just bring them out into the fore.
Yeah, exactly. I understand the reason, you know, I can understand doing that if you're, you know, for example, if you're The Edge's guitar tech and, you know, you're playing to 300,000 people, like missing a pedal isn't really an option. You know what I mean? When you go to hit a solo or something, and, or, you know, you go to hit that delay pedal and you miss it. I can see why when you get to that level that, I mean, I still think it would be cooler if the musicians were doing it themselves, but I do understand why they would do that.
So Edge has a whole bunch of guys on pedals below the stage.
Yeah. A lot of people do. They're kind of controlling the sounds underneath the stage. But yeah, he's one. I think a lot of
people
do.
And he'd be
that.
An extreme example of, he's not even really a guitarist. The guitarist more the medium for sound effects. And he's, to give him his due, he's really good at that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But as opposed to the other extreme, like Angus Young or something, who just plugs it into the amplifier.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Two very different styles.
Did you ever see the film It Might Get Loud?
We watched it together, Tom.
Oh no! Have I just broken your heart?
Yeah. Well, that's probably the last time I actually saw you. It's got to be many years now, but yeah, we watched it at your cabin on Belmont Lake.
Okay.
Yeah, it was The Edge. It was Jack White, and it was Jimmy Page.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was an interesting deal. But if I would have, those would not be the three representative guitarists from various eras as they were presented. But that, I guess it's just the three that decided to get together. So, but it's really stuck with me. Some of the comments they made. I remember The Edge. One thing he said in that video was, or that documentary, was that every time he thinks guitar is going to just disappear and be irrelevant, something appears that changes all that. I think the example, this might be from a completely different interview, but, you know, Eddie Van Halen just blew the lid off of the 70s guitar, and the next decade is all about that sound.
Yeah!
and nobody saw that coming. Although I have to say nowadays, I mean, guitar is probably in some ways at an all-time low. I mean, obviously there are a lot of people still use them, but it's not where it once was. It's been dethroned.
Absolutely. And I find that terrifying.
Terrifying and liberating all at once. You can just do your thing now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, I think there's a certain power to the sound of a guitar that cannot be matched by electronic instruments, shall I say?
Yeah, fair enough. And if you just, being a metalhead in the 80s, synthesizers were not allowed. And it was heartbreaking, you know, when they started to appear on your Iron Maiden and Judas Priest albums, like, A2 Brute! You know, trying to, pop metal, man, I'll tell you what, that just, it's like everyone felt like they had to do pop metal by the end of the 80s. And at that point, you know, heavy metal's on the way out.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to that documentary, I kind of feel bad for The Edge because he doesn't really come off very, very well compared to the other two. And I did notice that Jimmy Page is the executive producer, so he sort of had like a vested interest to make himself look good, which he always kind of does, you know.
I think that's one of his gifts. If you trace him back to the beginning, when he was just not run of the mill, I'm sure he was quite talented, but studio musician.
Yeah. Yeah. So you said that you wouldn't, you wouldn't have necessarily thrown those three guitar players together. Which ones would you throw together?
Tough question right there. Yeah. I mean, in a certain sense, it's fair enough, that combination. Okay, I'll go ahead and I'll say the thing that dare not be said. I've never seen the big deal about Jack White.
Okay, yeah.
I recognize his talent and his approach, his unique approach, but...
Dude, he has a bowling alley in his house.
All right, he's a cool guy. And he's got a big elephant head and all of that kind of stuff, which I saw on American Pickers. They sold him a big $10,000 head. But it's more his, if anything's innovative about him, it's his approach. As far as guitar playing, not so much.
Yeah, I think his genius is marketing and finding a niche for himself. And I think that's also, there's always a certain amount of luck, right? But he's a pretty interesting character. There's that great he started that great Third Man Records. And I saw a video of it, a little tour of it. I think it's in Nashville. I saw a tour of it online recently, and man, that is a cool place. They've got a little sound booth where you can go and record directly onto vinyl.
And cool.
Neil Young did just that. He showed up with an acoustic guitar, and I think he recorded a whole album direct to vinyl.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old time movie, but a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark, or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that.
I'll give him consistency on that one. I mean, he has been pro vinyl from the minute CD started to appear. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, it seems like he's right. When the CDs first came out, or not when they first came out. I mean, we've got I think the very, very first commercial CD was an organ player named Virgil Fox. Very first digital recording. And you ever hear of Virgil Fox?
It rings a bell, but I don't know anything about him.
Very innovative. The hippies dug him because he had all these layers and stuff in his live shows. Although I guess more traditional organ players see him as just a kind of a hack and a sellout. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he had as far as I can remember, he had the very first digital recording. But then by the mid to late 80s, CDs are just taking over. And granted, I mean, cassettes, I mean, every cassette you had to put up with underneath every song, you know? And of course, on vinyl, you know, between songs, once you played it a few times, you got that staticky hiss. Mm-hmm. But Neil Young from then CDs come out, it's real clean. But Neil Young's like, this isn't right. It's tinny. It's too clean. Mm-hmm. And certainly in retrospect, if you listen to those if you put in like a CD, if it hasn't digitally decayed by now from like 87, it sounds tinny. Mm. They've gotten better because it was 8-bit recordings. I think finally 24 and beyond bits. Then even the vinyl junkies finally had to kind of concede that, all mm-hmm. right, this sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've done an excruciatingly amount of reading into this, and I think the problem really about CDs is that they tried to in that era they tried to compress everything to make everything so loud, and so everything in terms of rock bands, everything that you hear on a CD sounds super compressed. And I've actually been dorky enough to sit there and record and listen to albums, the same album on vinyl and on a CD, and some sound great, but as soon as you put drums in there and you try and make everything super loud, it sounds really squished compared to a record. So I don't think it's necessarily so much the medium. It was interestingly enough, it was what they could do with the medium of CDs that actually made it less good.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And dorky.
Yeah. And so if you listen to like a classical recording on CD, they usually sound pretty great, or acoustic album or something like that. But as soon as you put something that's loud, that's meant to be loud, the loudest thing on the radio, they sound good on their own. And then if you play it next to your record, there's a totally different experience there.
It's true. And the classical people were really the first to latch onto CDs. It's like the violin player's right next to me, man.
But yeah, it's funny to see all the waves of the vinyl resurgence, and now tapes are in now. I'm not sure if you've noticed that, but that's and then now actually CDs are kind of having a resurgence, and a lot of people are kind of annoyed that they've thrown out all their CDs because they're having a bit of a resurgence as well.
Well, who would your three guitarists be? Would you agree with those three choices? I still haven't answered the question. I'm just buying some time here. So,
I mean,
if you could, 70s, 80s, 90s, say, or 60s, 70s, however you want to do it, who would be the representative guitarist?
That's so hard, because the 70s, I mean, you could pick someone, you could pick someone like Jimmy Page, but then you could pick someone who's like, a punker, like a Tom Verlaine or for me, Paul Weller, or, it's kind of an impossible question, and I don't exactly know how they came up with the concept of those three, but I think it is kind of interesting. Well, I guess the Edge is like kind of the odd man out for sure.
To be fair on that, he really has a different sound.
Yeah.
Than pretty much anybody else, and if they sound like the Edge, it's usually because they're imitating him with digital delay and all those effects that he likes to use.
Yeah,
I mean, he even spilled the beans on that documentary. He plays two notes and runs it through 10 pedals, and it's like it's this orchestra playing.
Yeah, Yeah, and I think he, I don't think he gets his due. I think what he did for that sound, it changed everything. I think it continues to be influential. So, you know, I think a lot of times people focus on virtuosity, and it's not really the important part of what makes music good. I think so often the thing that make things interesting are limitations. Someone, for example, Joni Mitchell, who had polio as a kid and wasn't really strong enough to play the guitar in a traditional way. So she ended up coming up with all these alternate tunings that she could play. And of course, they're incredible. I think there's always something to be said. I mean, if you think about, tube amps, why do tube amps, why does everyone still play tube amps that, you know, technology that should have gone out 60 years ago? Well, because you're pushing the medium to its limit, and there's something amazing about that. And it's the same thing that happens in a human voice when it's being stressed. There's a distortion there that somehow, manages to provide more feeling than the clean version.
Yeah, hear, hear. Yeah, it's just got me thinking about, you know, the limitations and getting past them. I mean, Django Reinhardt playing with two fingers.
Yes,
more
absolutely.
Than most people can do with 10. Tony Iommi slicing his fingers at a steel mill to the point he had, ultimately it led to his sound. He had to tune all the way down to a C.
Yeah,
and so
right.
It's this boom. And okay, he made it happen.
I think limitations are huge. And to go back to, you know, our conversation about records versus CDs, in some ways, the fact that they couldn't compress recordings that went onto vinyl the same way as CDs is why today they sound to me better because they physically couldn't, you know what I mean? That was a limitation of that medium, was that you couldn't put that much bass into a recording or the needle would jump off the record kind of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Right. And the constant resurgences of different technologies and the nostalgia for it or whatever. Yeah. I mean, back to cassettes. I mean, you threw them in the back seat unless they melted. It's like they were durable, you know, and just pop them in.
Until they unwound, which they often did.
Unwound or started to screech if you played it enough times. No, they, I mean, they like everything. It's just this cheap little reel to reel thing, but it, like everything else, has its limitations. Of course, then, of course, the 8-track was just a complete train wreck.
I have a friend who he's got into quadraphonic sound, and I think he claims that the 8-track sound amazing on quad. I think there are 8-tracks specifically made for quad.
Okay.
So I've yet to hear it, but I'm interested to hear it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, tell me a little more about this song, getting back to the You've Killed My Brother bit.
Well, I don't actually know that much more about it. I just thought it was a curiosity. I clearly remember it from my childhood, watching it with my family. And, you know, it's been a joke with my little nieces. I'll just be like, didn't you kill my brother? Come here, go away. That's kind of like a running line with us. So, and they know exactly what I'm talking about when I do that. So
was it a big, did people quote it around Etobicoke CI?
You know, I'm not sure. And you know, it's interesting how these trends kind of take over schools sometimes, because I feel like my school is pretty divided between a whole lot of different factions. But I do remember my cousins went to a school where everyone was obsessed with the Ramones. Like obsessed. It was weird.
It is weird.
And I never saw that anywhere else, but it just spread throughout the school, and it was very odd.
And truly it wasn't rock and roll really high school.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't really a time that the Ramones were, no one was really paying attention to them at that time. So it's just interesting. I remember there was a lot, you know, I don't know. There was a lot of talk about Neil Young at my school. I do remember that. And it, like, weirdly, like a lot of preppy kids like Neil Young, which is very odd.
That is strange. Then again, it is in Canada, so there's a whole another element there.
Yeah.
Yeah, trends are, well, when probably one of the songs I'll spring on you in the near future will go deep into this area we're talking about. It's like, wait, those people are listening to this? That ain't right. Something happened.
Right.
But I can't reveal any more than that, or I'll reveal the song. That one I guarantee you will know, though. Everybody does.
Well, it's funny. We keep saying, I guess I didn't assume you were going to know this song, but it was pretty big, you know, when I was a kid. So, but I guess it just didn't make it to the States, and understandably, because it's really bizarre.
Well, again, but why not? That's a curious thing. I'm going to look it up. And again, it might just went under, it might have just gone under my radar. So yeah. Maybe everyone else knew this except for me at Bell High School in Frostburg, Maryland.
Yeah. I did notice that he's active, and he has a podcast, Alexi Sale, now, and so I'm kind of curious to see what he's, and he seems to cover serious topics as well. He's not just a comedian, you know.
But he was a stand-up comedian or something like that?
Yeah, I think so. And he's pretty highly regarded, yeah, you know, as being one of the top British comedians, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, so we were talking about crossover genre types. He just decided to make a song.
Yeah, I have no idea what the reasoning was. It's truly bizarre.
Or why he did it the way he did.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a different era, right? Where someone would be like, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna make this a pop song. We're gonna take this. Sort of like older guy, balding guy comedian, and we're gonna make a pop song and do a weird video. But I mean, no one would get the funding to do that nowadays.
And rightly so, in most cases.
True, but I would argue that we're missing out a lot on a lot of sort of quirky individuals, because these kind of what would be the word, extravagances are not allowed.
Right. And certainly the 80s was all about this kind of experimentation. One we missed when we were talking about this that should be painfully obvious, and I'm tempted to keep it as a song in the future, but I'll just mention it now, is Sam Kinison doing Wild Thing. Do you remember that?
Vaguely?
I mean, it was just a ridiculous rendition of it.
Okay.
That showcased his comedic talents, which were immense. I mean, the guy was pretty funny. Yeah. The song wasn't terribly funny past one listen of it, but it was a huge hit.
Came to my mind, I thought I'd say that. You made me trust you, then stuck the knife in my heart. You're a lying, unfaithful, untrustable tramp, and I think I love you.
Well, I guess, so then what other kind of crossovers? I mean, we've talked about opera. Do you see any other kind of,
I'm not a big fan of it. Because it sort of just ran it ran its course, and then it just gets ridiculous. Although let me put it this way, it's really got to work, or it just doesn't, or it just sounds terrible. Like I remember hearing chamber music that were Metallica songs or
and it just.
It's like, okay, this isn't this. Yeah, these guys are very talented and all of that, but this really just doesn't work. And it's too cute, but yet it's not gonna last. There's actually that's just my take on it. There's actually a band in down here in the States, and I can't think of their name right now, but they bluegrassize everything, and they do every album by a different band. Like there's like bluegrass Nirvana, bluegrass Guns N' Roses, yeah. And a lot of it is actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see if I can, the name's escaping me right now, but I want to say Iron Horse.
Okay.
But I'll see if I can round some of that up too. But it's got to offer something other than just a quick chuckle in that that the original doesn't have, just like any cover.
It's funny when you said that about the, you know, sort of bluegrass versions of metal songs. When I worked in a music store, I used to do a bluegrass version of Enter Sandman that always got chuckles from the people that I was trying to sell guitars to. It was kind of like boom ba da 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 boom da boom da boom da 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 boom da boom da.
I can see it lending itself to that.
It worked pretty well. Yeah.
I can see that. In fact, yeah, there is a Metallica album that particular band did do.
Okay.
And I rest assured it's on there.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think you're right that you have to kind of get beyond the gimmick for it to,
yeah, that's right,
to be anything lasting, you know? And there's certainly lots of gimmicky things like that.
Right. I mean, a large part of what this podcast is the novelty song.
Right.
But trying to figure out why it appeared and when it appeared and what was, what was important about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that can, you know, maybe it's just a one-off, or maybe there was something bigger going on.
Maybe when, you know, comedy made its way into music, we needed some kind of a release valve, you know, maybe there was something heavy going on and that's why this was kind of like just a silly thing that struck a chord with people.
If you will. There was also another way to look at it. I mean, the best stuff is stuff that was not meant to be funny, then it's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of my heroes, of course, Screaming Lord Sutch. You ever hear of him?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
Only
yeah.
through you.
Over. Well, there you go, yeah. That's one for the, I mean, usually the album, which is hanging on my wall right behind me, by the way, it's usually rated the worst album of all time. But it's got Jimmy Page, John Bonham on it, Keith Moon's on one of the albums, but all these heavy hitters, like all, it's got all these names. In fact, the album's called Heavy Friends. It's got a big list. I will take 2 seconds and read them. Jimmy Page, John Bonham, Jeff Beck, Noel Redding, Nicky Hopkins.
Wow.
And maybe, yeah, Lord Such might be one for a special episode of Hit Songs from Mars. Not that there are any hits, but it was, people bought that because they saw those names. But what he'd done is he tricked everyone into recording on his album. And they were all furious with him because it was just like, you want to come screw around in the studio? Yeah, sure, why not? And then he secretly was recording everything.
Wow.
But it's hysterical. And some of it's unlistenably bad, but some of it's not bad, and it's good. But what was interesting, though, it rated the worst album ever, and to a certain extent, reasonably so. But once it started to appear on YouTube, someone posted Lord Such on YouTube, and I start scrolling down the comments, and a lot of it was like, I don't see what's so bad about this. right. Like post-punk, it was perfectly acceptable. So it just a rawer sound and things like that. Another one I was thinking of earlier, William Shatner albums where he's singing.
Yes.
It's not funny and it's not good, but yet together it's hysterical. And he's made a career out of that. Yeah, I mean, he does cheesy commercials where he's supposed to be funny, but isn't. But it works somehow.
Yeah, that's true. His whole post-Star Trek career has been kind of a spoof.
She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have a rum and Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And in 30 seconds' time, she said, I want to live like common people. I want to do whatever common people do. I want to sleep with common people. I want to sleep with common people like you. Well, what
it's
else
funny because when
do?
You were talking about the Lord Such and all the people that played on it, for some reason my mind went straight to being a pedal steel player. How terrible Jimmy Page's pedal steel playing is on that one song. I don't remember. Do you remember what song?
Oh,
that
your
is?
Time is gonna come.
That sounds right.
On the first album.
Yeah, it's just atrociously out of tune. And I just think it was just so funny that they decided to leave it on there. I mean, I kind of love that about music from that era is how many things that weren't quite right and they just left it because it had a good vibe or whatever, you know?
I think Page was always the first to admit how terrible he was on a pedal steel.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on the other side of it, maybe you would disagree, Jerry Garcia had played pedal steel for 2 weeks just messing around with it, and it's on the Crosby, Stills, and Nash Teach Your Children, and it's a very memorable, very nice steel sound.
Yep.
If they told you you would die, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
Yeah, he no, it's very good. And I think a lot of the time you And that's, again, it's kind of, there's a theme here about limitations. When you don't know a lot about something, you sometimes are just thinking more about melody than technical details or whatever. So I think there's a lot to be said. I mean, when I learned pedal steel, it the same thing kind of happened. It immediately kind of made sense to me, and you could find certain things that were simple but good quickly. And then often as you progress, sometimes your parts are not so memorable because they're less melodic, you know?
Yeah, I gotcha. And
you could apply that to any instrument, I think.
Yeah, there was like Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. The organ in that, I think it was Al Cooper, was that who played the organ on that? But he was just learning the thing, so it's off by like a 3/4 of a beat. And because he's just trying to find it.
Yeah.
And Dylan loved it.
Yeah.
And it really is kind of one of those little things that makes that song nice. You used to, and then suddenly he finds it, and it's in. Yeah.
You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scared.
No, absolutely. And I think all those old guys, apparently they, I've listened to quite a bit of, podcasts and various interviews with people who have worked with people like Neil Young and Dylan. And you better, if you're playing with them, you better get it right early, because they only play it like 2 or 3 times. And if you don't get it right in those times, that's what's going on record.
No 60 takes.
Yeah, no, exactly. Neil Young is notorious for that, for sure. And I think Dylan's the same way. They just don't have patience to, and I mean, that's what they did when they were, probably when they were younger, they probably were told to keep playing it, like they weren't as, they couldn't just call all the shots in their very early days.
Right. And very often producers that made them do things better often had a point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean, well, Neil Young, I mean, that's what he's all about. I mean, if you listen to this, I mean, they're, like Down by the River or something like that, where he does, 64 bar solos that are technically can be awful, but it's just all about what he's doing, and it works. Mm-hmm. It works for him.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas, Eric Clapton's much cleaner or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It works for very different approaches. But yeah, I can see Neil Young not wanting to do 65 takes on a certain song.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's funny. I remember hearing that, Refugee by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. I think they did 68 takes or something crazy. And in the end, they used the first take.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a cliche, but it is true.
Yeah.
Each time you play it, you're losing something that's kind of intangible. And then sometimes you need someone who hasn't been around and just to listen to it and be like, oh no, this one had a better feeling, for whatever reason, it puts a smile on my face,
Yeah. Elvis Presley's Hound Dog, they did 31 takes and they went with number 27 though. So as a counterpoint.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely something about, the first time you hear a song or the first time you play on a song, there's something, that can be kind of magical, because I don't know what it is. It's like, you're kind of just wandering and suddenly you find it and it seems to be more, you play it more poignantly or something. I don't know.
No, it's just, it's going to get stale after 68 takes.
For sure. Yeah.
Just there's no way around that. Maybe there's a perfect moment, 5th or 6th, where the technical side kinks are worked out, but it's still relatively fresh or something along those lines. But,
mm-hmm. Well, and obviously such a big thing that's changed over the years is that in those days people would all play together and they'd all have to get it right together. And now these days, songs are recorded bit by bit. You start with the drums and build it up, and everyone's basically, they're not playing with people, they're playing with machinery basically. And it's funny because I remember explaining this to my aunt, and she was like, well, how do you get any feeling? I was like, yeah, exactly. How do you get any feeling? There's definitely a different thing that happens when you're in a room with people playing music and you're all kind of mutually vulnerable. That's an amazing thing. It's not the same thing when you're playing to a, you know, a band that's already laid down the tracks and you're just adding something. It's not the same feeling at all. And it means you can probably make a technically better take, but it's not necessarily going to have the feeling, you know?
Thanks for tuning in to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars. We hope you enjoyed yourself and learned a few things along the way.
For a complete list of songs you heard in this episode, visit us at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. We hope you'll support the artists we featured by purchasing their music.
If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and you'll receive new episodes as soon as they become available.
We've been recording all winter and spring and have many more surprising hit songs to share with you.
While you're at it, if you could give us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, that would really help us out. We would like to thank The Reverb Syndicate for providing the theme song for our podcast. They have an extensive catalog of tunes just as rockin' as the one you hear here.
Hear, hear.
You can find them at thereverbsyndicate.ca and on Facebook, SoundCloud, and Bandcamp, which typically pays artists the most. We would also like to thank Eric Minot for designing our podcast icon. You can find his design and illustration work on Instagram at MinoGraphics. That's MinoGraphics. You can connect with us on Twitter at Songs from Mars and at hsfm.buzzsprout.com.
Feel free to disagree, praise, correct, and chastise us.
We would also love to hear your idea of a hit song from Mars and why you think it fits the mold. Even better, if you felt like recording a voice memo and sending it our way, you can email us at hitsongsfrommars@gmail.com. We may even feature it on the show. Until next time, Earthlings.